This is 1A. Happy Friday. I'm Joshua Johnson visiting KQED Public Radio in San Francisco. California has a lot to decide in the midterms. Who will be the next governor? And will the state's congressional races contribute to a predicted blue wave across the nation? There's also renewed political energy on both sides of the aisle now that Brett Kavanaugh is on the Supreme Court. How might Republicans and Democrats use that to their advantage? Joining us today here at KQED to discuss these and all the big stories in the week's news across the country is Lily Jamali, the co-host and correspondent for the station's statewide news magazine, The California Report. Lily, welcome to 1A.
Great to be here and welcome back to KQED.
Thank you very much. Joining us from our home base in D.C. is political journalist and sometimes fill-in host Todd Zwillick. Hey, Todd.
Hi, Josh.
And Shane Harris covers intelligence and national security for The Washington Post. Good to have you back, Shane.
Hi from afar, Joshua.
It would also be good, if not great, to have your questions and thoughts about this week's top stories. So email us, 1a@wamu.org. Comment on our Facebook page where you can watch us video streaming from San Francisco, or tweet us at 1a. Let's begin with the weather, which made big news this week. You know, it's been more than 50 years since the United States had a storm like Hurricane Michael. Florida's panhandle bore the brunt of the damage. That's where it made landfall. Many beachfront homes are in pieces, splinters at best, and a number of water rescues are underway. More than a million power customers in Florida, Georgia, the Carolinas, and Virginia are disconnected, and the death toll rose overnight to at least 11. The director of FEMA, Brock Long, or the administrator of FEMA, spoke to CNN's John Berman this morning on New Day.
What's the biggest challenge you and your teams are facing this morning?
Well, access to all the areas is one thing. Search and rescue is where we are hyper-focused this morning. But simultaneously, what we're trying to do is assess roadways and bridges to make sure that we can get, you know, teams, commodities, and equipment into the areas that were hardest hit. The hospital system near Panama City, in and around Panama City, took a hit, too. So we have to stabilize the health and medical capabilities that are there. Over 30,000 workers from around the United States have been pre-staged to try to work as quickly as possible to get the power back on. But here again, it's all about access. We got to make sure that it's safe to travel down roadway corridors and get in there to start rebuilding the power grid, which could take a very long time at this point.
That's FEMA Administrator Brock Long speaking this morning on CNN. He also expressed some frustration with Floridians who did not mind the updates to the building codes, which were updated in 2001. Pretty clear to see which homes were up to code and which were not. You can tell which homes were up to code because they were still standing when Michael is gone. Todd Zwillick, talk about the kind of pressure that FEMA is under with this recovery effort, especially considering that these kinds of strong storms may well become more frequent in the near future.
A devastating storm, huge sections. You saw some of the drone coverage and aerial photos. Entire sections of Mexico Beach in Florida essentially erased. A devastating storm, even if the death toll is not the horrible numbers that we heard from Hurricane Maria in Puerto Rico. Belated numbers, by the way. So you asked about the government and their response. FEMA has, of course, fallen under increased scrutiny since Hurricane Katrina in New Orleans, and quite appropriately so. Many of the shortfalls from Hurricane Maria in Puerto Rico don't seem to have fallen squarely on FEMA's shoulders. And indeed, the federal government in this case, I think, managed to skirt a lot of the responsibility for a response that outraged many Americans, and certainly many Americans in Puerto Rico. I think once the storm assessment is done here, Joshua, one of the things that you're going to see is sort of the after damage assessment, and then lawmakers on Capitol Hill asking for disaster relief money. There will be an opportunity in December in the lame duck session for another appropriations fight. That'll be a fight, but embedded in that fight, we'll see what kind of will the Republican Congress has to send relief money through FEMA largely down to help Florida and Georgia and the Carolinas recover.
Shane Harris, what have we heard from the president so far on Hurricane Michael, the devastation and also the recovery effort. What's he been saying?
Well, he has largely praised it. And of course, he spent a lot of time in Florida and had good things to say about the resiliency and the professionalism of emergency management and first responders in Florida. He knows well, of course, as Todd was just saying, what the outrage was to the response with Hurricane Maria. And previous, the hurricane previous to this, of course, President Trump inspired so much outrage and pushback when he questioned whether the death toll that now stands at more than 3,000 people in Puerto Rico was accurate and accused Democrats of making up the number. So he will have good things to say as long as the response goes well. And really for any president, FEMA and the whole disaster response works well when you can depoliticize it as much as possible and really let the professionals take over with the response. And that appears to be what's happening now here as well. It's also going to be, though, the aftermath. You heard Brock Long talking about rebuilding the power grid. There are houses that, if they are even rebuilt, will have to be completely rebuilt. Now that the brunt of the storm is over, it was very quick and very powerful, few dead, but the cleanup here is massive. If that is slow, if people aren't getting the money, the relief that they need, if there are problems with claim adjustments, as there were during Hurricane Sandy, that's where it all comes back to roost for the White House.
Now, add to just the raw devastation of Hurricane Michael, the conversation that many people had been having this week about the nature of climate change. Mm. This week, the UN released a major report on climate change, which came with very dire warnings for the planet. President Trump had a fairly skeptical reaction to the report's findings. Listen.
It was given to me, and I want to look at who drew it, you know, which group drew it, because I couldn't give you reports that are fabulous, and I can give you reports that aren't so good. But I will be looking at it, absolutely.
Part of what the president said after this report came out, worth noting that the report was compiled by a consortium of scientists from around the world, one of whom we spoke to on this program this week. You'll find that program online at the1a.org. Lily Jamali, I wonder what your sense is of how, you know, the administration's response to this report might affect the way we deal with storms like this in the future.
Yeah, well, you know, as you mentioned, this is from a credible source. This is the IPCC, and they've been putting these reports out for years now. What strikes me about this one in particular is that people are actually talking about it. It seems to have penetrated that complacency barrier that we often run into when we talk about climate change.
And I'm sorry, I should say the IPCC is the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. It's this international group that's kind of under the aegis of the UN.
Right, exactly. And the main message here is not one of pure despair, although it does outline, you know, some very scary scenarios if you see global temperatures rise, even incrementally from, you know, say 1.5 degrees Celsius to 2 degrees Celsius. But there is the sense here that you can still do something, that we can still do something about this. And, you know, California, Californians often joke we're the home of the resistance against Donald Trump. And certainly on this issue, that's been the case. To your question, Governor Jerry Brown has made the fight against climate change a signature issue. He'll joke about how he's going to be long gone by the time some of these worst case scenarios come to pass. But he's really trying to make California be seen as a leader at a time when the feds are pushing back against the science. And you heard Donald Trump, the tone that he's taken on that in that soundbite you just played.
Yeah, and in terms of being able to deal with a challenge this big, it's also worth noting that the Nobel Prize in Economics went out at the start of this week to Paul Romer and William Nordhaus. The two of them had been studying the economics of climate change. Nordhaus has endorsed a universal carbon tax. Romer's research shows that humans are innovative enough to solve a challenge even as big as climate change. So perhaps that's some reason for some hope. We are here at KQED speaking to Lily Jamali, co-host and correspondent with the California Report, political journalist Todd Zwillick, and Shane Harris of The Washington Post. We welcome your questions and thoughts about this or any of the big stories across the country that made news this week, 1A@WAMU.org. Bill wrote on our Facebook page, "I wrote out Camille at Kessler Air Force Base in 1969, so this level of destruction looks familiar." Kessler's in Mississippi, by the way. John commented on our Facebook Facebook page, can you please discuss the National Flood Insurance Program and how its past pattern of payouts contributes to financial losses by tacitly encouraging people who live in floodplains to stay where they are? We actually did a program about flood insurance that I would refer you to, John, just so you can hear it in a little more depth. You'll find that online at the1a.org. But Todd Zwillick, I think it's worth noting that the policy questions around what we do with these big storms are getting more present, and it seems like more urgent, particularly with reports like the one that came out this week on climate change.
How many more devastating storms do we have to see in this country and others before Americans collectively and their leaders take this threat seriously? You had sort of the shruggy response from the president of the United States. From here inside the Beltway, responses from Republicans on Capitol Hill who were asked about the report this week, Joshua, and the responses range from dismissive to jokily dismissive, senators making jokes, I might as well sprout wings and fly to Mars. I mean, just an utter blindness on the part of some of our leaders. I'll bring you back to Professor Nordhaus. You mentioned him. He did win the Nobel Prize for endorsing the carbon tax. The IPCC says that a carbon tax now, at this point, may never get us to the point of carbon reductions that we need. And maybe there's a little bit of optimism at the base of the report, but Professor Nordhaus, I'll read you a quote because it was remarkable to me. It's hard to be optimistic, and we're actually going backward in the United States with the disastrous policies of the Trump administration. Those are the words of the man who just won the Nobel Prize for Economics for his work on carbon reduction.
We'll continue our conversation on this in just a moment with Todd Zwillick, Shane Harris, and Lily Jamali. Coming up, Taylor Swift and Kanye West have a long history as celebrity rivals, and this week they showed their political stripes at different ends of the spectrum. We'll also talk about reaction here in the U.S. to what could be the murder of a leading Saudi journalist by the Saudi government. Jamal Khashoggi had been living in Virginia, and there is growing concern about his fate. We'll also get to more of your questions and thoughts as well. I'm Joshua Johnson. Glad to be with you from San Francisco. You're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR. This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. It's the Friday News Roundup with political journalist Todd Zwillick, reporter Shane Harris of The Washington Post, and Lily Jamali of KQED's California Report. We'd love to hear from you, too. Feel free to tweet us at 1A, comment on our Facebook page where you can watch our video stream, or email 1A@WAMU.org. Before we move on from the weather and the climate, Lily, there was one more thing you wanted to drop in.
Yeah, I just wanted to mention, you know, Paul Romer, the other guy who won the Nobel Prize in Economics this week, talking about carbon taxes being the solution to this crisis, at least in part. And, you know, I think it's important to just recognize that sounds punitive, but I think there is a positive message that he's trying to put out there. And that is, if you commit to a tax on carbon, not only are you dealing with this issue head on, but you're also, in his view, opening up the opportunity for people to make money, investors to make money off of this. Because when money's at stake, you're always going to find alternatives. People will naturally gravitate. And the economic argument is often on carbon tax that it's bad for business. California is the fifth largest economy in the world. And Jerry Brown just signed an executive order committing the state to carbon neutrality by 2045, which I'm sure sounds crazy to people outside of the state. But that's actually very close to one of the policy prescriptions the IPCC set forth.
It's kind of crazy until you do it, really. And California is very serious about doing it.
It's very serious about doing it. You know, Paul Romer talks about the problem isn't going to be solved until you build consensus. And political will is really at the heart of that. There's really a huge divide in terms of political will, not just here, but also, you know, I just moved here from Canada. Same thing there. You have Prime Minister Justin Trudeau trying to impose a carbon tax across the country, and he's running into real opposition at the provincial level there.
Before we move on, let me get to one more comment, a few more comments on this. Not My Economy tweeted, "Why are we still talking about the credibility of science when it comes to climate change?" Good point, Not My Economy. I don't know if you listen to this program, but we are not questioning the credibility. That's kind of a done deal on this program. But I hear what you're saying. Larry tweeted, "It's frustrating to hear criticism of citizens in some of the poorest parts of Florida for not upgrading their home's ability to withstand hurricanes. They may live where other people vacation, but they're mostly stuck. This storm will expose that contrast." Shane Harris, I wonder if you could respond to Larry. On one hand, I disagree with him as a Floridian. Like, the state of Florida has programs to help you harden your home. And if you want to live in Florida, that is a basal risk of living within yards of a rising coastline. If you want to live there, you just have to absorb that. On the other hand, I totally hear where he's coming from. Like, if Mexico Beach, where the Hurricane Michael made landfall, had to be moved back from the coastline for safety's sake, the town could unincorporate. It's a tough one.
No, it is really tough. And when we're thinking about climate change in the sort of 30 to 40 year arc, Todd and I were just talking about this during the break. There are existential risks that are posed not just to communities close to the coastline, the one we're talking about today, but large cities, you know, like Miami in Florida and other places that really in the long term are going to have to make serious, profound choices about survivability, about resilience, about whether people want to continue living there. And there is an element of risk that you take, but that also has to give people some agency. And what I think is missing from the conversation about climate change is a real honest discussion about long-term risk and what the responsibility is for people living in these places and their elected leaders, both at the local and the national level. We are not having that conversation.
And Joshua, one small point just to end. Mm-hmm. If you think that risk and getting your heads around the risk for lower income or poor people here in America is something we need to think about, Americans also need to think about what some of our international leaders, generals like Colin Powell, advisors, have been saying for years. If you think it's a risk in this country, imagine what storms, increased drought, and conflict means for millions and millions of poor people around the world when they start to migrate, when they upset the relationships between countries. And that becomes not just their problem in terms of life and death, but America's problem in terms of keeping the world in order.
Well, listen, for those of you who are in and had been in the path of Hurricane Michael, we wish you, of course, a speedy recovery, and we'd love to hear from you as you continue to deal with the recovery. Give us a sense of how you're doing, how the recovery is going, what your thoughts are on how things are going, how well FEMA is meeting your needs. State officials, how well that's going. We always love to hear from you. Feel free to email us, 1A@WAMU.org. You can always leave us a voicemail at 855-236-1A1A. We know connectivity is probably bad where you are, so be careful moving around if you have to find a cell signal. Please stay safe. Do not put your health at risk for the sake of sending us a voicemail. But if you're able, we'd love to know how you're doing. 855-236-1A1A. Let's move on to the White House, where another major official is leaving the administration. Nikki Haley, the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, announced her resignation on Tuesday.
A lot of people are going to want to say there's a lot of reasons why I'm leaving. The truth is, I want to make sure that this administration, the president, has the strongest person to fight. It was a blessing to go into the UN with body armor every day and defend America. And I'll always do that. I'll never truly step aside from fighting for our country. But I will tell you that I think it's time.
Nikki Haley speaking on Tuesday about resigning as the U.S. ambassador to the UN. Now, this resignation was different from some of the others we've seen in this administration because it seemed to kind of come out of nowhere by surprise. Last month, Ambassador Haley published an op-ed in the Washington Post declaring her loyalty to and respect for the president. Shane, what is your read on Nikki Haley's resignation announcement? Do we take it at face value? Is there more at play here? What do you think?
Well, there's always more at play, particularly in this White House. It was a surprise. There's no doubt about that. It was a surprise even to people in the administration. Nikki Haley also, I think, had found herself increasingly politically isolated in the power centers of foreign policy in the administration with John Bolton, the National Security Advisor, and Mike Pompeo, now Secretary of State, sort of absorbing a lot of that energy. And then, of course, this administration being quite hostile to the United Nations, being UN ambassador is not necessarily the most powerful position. Nikki Haley has presidential ambitions. She said today in her meeting with Trump this week, she's not running in 2020. She plans to be campaigning for him. 2024 is not that long away. And so I think there's an element of that as well. The question of why now is a curious one that'll keep people in Washington guessing. She may have thought, get out before the midterms. There may be, certainly if Democrats take back the House, they are going to become a subpoena factory. This administration will be under investigation relentlessly. And Nikki Haley herself is under scrutiny for private jet flights that she accepted from friends and associates. There's been some investigation into that. It might have just been that now was the time to head for the exits. And I have to say, she really does leave probably in one of the best positions of any senior Trump administration official. She's not leaving under a cloud of scandal. She won generally plaudits for her work at the UN. She was seen as a stabilizing force within an administration that many people feel needs them. And she can leave with her head held high. And I think certainly someone as smart and capable and as ambitious as Nikki Haley, this is not her swan song.
Yeah, Lily, that was exactly what I was going to ask you about, is this kind of what you read into Nikki Haley's resignation compared to some of the other turnover in the Trump administration. I mean, it's not unprecedented for a U.S. ambassador to the U.N. to serve for a year. Some serve for 3 or 4 years, some serve for 1 year. So the sheer duration of her term isn't necessarily telling, but I don't know that we view this in the same light as, say, the way that, like, Rex Tillerson left or some of the other people in the administration.
Absolutely. That's a great point. I mean, frankly, 2 years seems like a natural timeline for somebody to serve in such a position and decide to call it quits. And Trevor Noah joked, you know, hey, at least this resignation was scandal free. So there's that. You know, it's been interesting watching a chorus of Democratic lawmakers praising her in the last few days, saying in some cases that they didn't have very high expectations of her going in, and they've sort of rethought that now that she's been there for 2 years and has done what they deem is a pretty good job. Having said that, the ACLU has been very critical of her tenure in this role. They say that she's undermined universal human rights and international bodies. They've criticized her for her role in the administration's pullout from UNHCR, the Human Rights Commission, and UNESCO. So, you know, it's not all positive and all, you know, hugs and kisses as she's leaving.
Just taking a look at the list of previous ambassadors to the UN, and, you know, the duration of the term varies. Some are a year. Henry Cabot Lodge Jr. served for like 7 years. Madeleine Albright served for 4 years. So there is a great deal of variety in terms of the durations of the term. But I wonder who we think might be serving the next term, Todd. We've heard Ivanka Trump's name thrown around. I think the president mentioned that. But do we have any idea yet as to who might be Ambassador Haley's successor?
Yes, let me knock down the biggest name for you right away, Joshua Johnson. Ivanka Trump, first daughter, was pretty quick to tweet out how honored she was to be considered, but that person will not be me. So we will not have Ambassador Ivanka Trump, at least not by her own reckoning. The biggest name that was being bandied about by the press as soon as Nikki Haley stepped down was Dina Powell, a former Deputy National Security Advisor. Dina Powell says yesterday she is staying at Goldman Sachs, where she is ensconced as an executive now and making plenty of money. People have thrown out Bob Corker's name. He's currently chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, not a Donald Trump ally. And as of January 1st, not a senator anymore. He's retiring. He's going to be looking for a job, probably hoping to make more money than he would make if he were UN ambassador. Again, those two gentlemen don't get along. But also, President Trump does have a demonstrated history of getting over it if he wants somebody to serve him. But there have been a couple of other names that have been put out as put around the beltway as well. Richard Grenell is a former spokesman at the UN, a current ambassador to Germany, I believe, and the highest ranking, I think, openly gay Republican in the administration. That's one little part of his bio. Mm-hmm. And also Brian Hook, who worked for Rex Tillerson. Rex Tillerson ousted, of course, as Secretary of State. And Brian is one of the people who managed to hang on at State and really keep his sort of keep his bona fides with the Trump administration. His name has been out there as well.
I'm Joshua Johnson. You're listening to 1A. Let's move on to an op-ed that was published this week in USA Today, written by the president himself. The headline, quote, "Democrats' Medicare for All plan will demolish promises to seniors," unquote. The op-ed began by laying out the president's opposition to the Medicare proposal from Senator Bernie Sanders. Then it transitioned to a broader criticism of Democrats. He wrote in part, quote, "The truth is that the centrist Democratic Party is dead. The new Democrats are radical socialists who want to model America's economy after Venezuela," unquote. Now, other journalists quickly criticized USA Today and pounced on the paper for publishing the op-ed, pointing out that nearly every single sentence contained something false. USA Today did have an online version of the op-ed that had some fact checks in it, but that does you no good if you read a newspaper on paper. Shane Harris, I wonder what you see in terms of the strategy of the White House publishing this op-ed. It's the first of its kind. How important really is it that it was tearing down this Medicare for All proposal? And how important is it that USA Today just kind of let it run as is?
You know, there's two thoughts on this. One is there's the political lens to look through this, which is that placing it in USA Today, which has a huge circulation and has a lot, I think, probably more market penetration in places where President Trump would like to get this message across than perhaps the New York Times or my paper, the Washington Post. What you're seeing here was almost the text version of a Trump rally where he will make all kinds of assertions, falsehoods, maybe lies. Let's call some of them lies. We can dissect them and categorize them. But this was really, I mean, I think my colleague at the Post, Glenn Kessler, who's the sort of the fact-checking gold standard, used that line you mentioned that nearly every sentence contains something misleading or a falsehood. In that sense, I think you can view this much more as a political document, a kind of rallying document. Then there comes the second question, which is, all right, if that's the case, what was the journalistic obligation of USA Today to push back on this? And I must say, I'm not on the editorial side, I'm on the news side, and there's a bit of a church and state separation. But if I were a media reporter, I would not be that impressed by USA Today's response to say, well, we give people a lot of leeway in their opinions. There is the old saying, you're entitled to your own opinions, but not your own facts, as Senator Moynihan said. It seemed like the leeway that USA Today was giving the president in this op-ed just ran crashing right into the wall of what the basic fact-checking is supposed to be about. So I'm still not quite understanding how the editors chose to go ahead and allow this to run in the form that it did. And it's frankly, it's a real embarrassment for USA Today.
And it is worth noting that on many papers, you know, even on the editorial team, Lily, there are fact checkers. Like there is an editor who edits editorials to make sure that they're accurate.
They're
or at least that they're grounded in the facts.
Absolutely. You know, I think Trump recognizes that this is going to be a rallying cry for the Democrats, not just in the midterms, but looking out ahead to 2020. This is something that here in California, U.S. Senator Kamala Harris is out front on talking about it. And she's actually the first person to back Senator Sanders on this last year, at least publicly. Newsom, Gavin Newsom, who is running for governor on the Democratic ticket, immediately took to Twitter to strike down Trump's comments in this op-ed. And he talked about Trump's support for the Graham-Cassidy bill, which would have allowed insurers to charge more for pre-existing conditions. This is absolutely something that Gavin Newsom is running on. He wants a government-run healthcare system. And Trump actually called him out in Montana a couple of weeks ago on this, saying not only does Newsom want universal healthcare, he also wants it to apply to undocumented immigrants. So Trump joked he may even move here to California to get the free healthcare.
One more story we'd like to start getting into before we have to pause, and that has to do with the newest Supreme Court Justice, Brett Kavanaugh. He was confirmed Saturday in a 50-48 Senate vote, sworn in as a justice over the weekend and on Monday in a ceremonial swearing in with the justice's family by his side. Listen.
Will you please repeat after me? I, Brett M. Kavanaugh, do solemnly swear.
I, Brett M. Kavanaugh, do solemnly swear.
That I will administer justice without respect to persons.
That I will administer justice without respect to persons.
part of the swearing-in ceremony for the newest Supreme Court Justice, Brett Kavanaugh. His confirmation to the Supreme Court comes after a months-long battle between Democrats and Republicans over that nomination. We'd like to talk more about how that confirmation has resonated across the country, and frankly, whether this fight is over. Some senators are vowing to continue that fight against Kavanaugh, so what would be their next move? We'll get into that when we continue our conversation with political journalist Todd Zwillick, Shane Harris, intelligence and national security reporter for The Washington Post, and Lily Jamali, co-host and correspondent of The California Report here at KQED. Brian in Bartlett, New Hampshire writes, does it strike anyone else as unseemly that Trump, in the midst of the Florida disaster, flew off to do a self-aggrandizing pep rally, then he follows with an absurd fawning over by Kanye? Is he totally tone deaf? I have family in Tallahassee that I have yet to hear from. We will talk about that rather fascinating visit with Kanye ahead. Stay close. Back now to the Friday News Roundup with Lily Jamali, Shane Harris, and Todd Zwillick. Still time to get in some more of your questions and thoughts on the week's top stories. 1A@WAMU.org. Todd Zwillick, let's talk a bit about Brett Kavanaugh. We're seeing his Supreme Court nomination and confirmation heavily politicized going into the midterms. President Trump is using the issue to energize Republicans. Democrats are doing the same thing on the other side of the aisle. I wonder where we see this going, especially since Democrats, some of them, seem determined not to let the Kavanaugh confirmation go.
It seems to have had opposite effects, or at least so it seems. These numbers are a little sketchy. I want to put the proviso around what I'm about to say, that the polls are fresh and we don't know exactly what this means yet for the upcoming midterms. We will know in 4 weeks. However, it looks like now it's having an opposite effect on Senate races and House races. We've seen several Senate races, places like Tennessee, places like North Dakota, where races that seem to be closer, where the Democrat who is challenging a Republican in a red state actually had a chance of either surviving or, in the case of Tennessee, maybe picking up an open seat, to now a surge for Republicans. The Brett Kavanaugh phenomenon seems to, in Senate races, have solidified Republican base voters behind Republican candidates in most cases. And then, curiously, in House races where so many Republicans are vulnerable, I can't say that it's had the opposite effect, because I'm not sure that a Supreme Court fight has a cause and effect relationship on House races. House members don't really have much to do with Supreme Court fights, at least not in confirming them. But there doesn't seem to have been the same erosion in a lead or in Democratic support in the House. However, looking forward, and you mentioned that a lot of Democrats are promising their base that the fight isn't over on Brett Kavanaugh, not necessarily because of his ideological positions on Roe or executive power, but what his behavior was in high school and college, and more importantly, perhaps, whether he was truthful under oath in front of the Judiciary Committee and in his statements when he talked about his drinking, when he talked about his behavior in high school and college. I would look to the House, most likely. House members who may, if the numbers hold true, control the House after January. They will control the Judiciary Committee. They will control the investigations committees. They will have chairmanships. And like Shane said before, they will become subpoena factories. They will also have to respond to a base that wants Brett Kavanaugh's statements investigated. A lot of this, Joshua, comes from dissatisfaction over the extremely limited nature of that FBI background check, that week in between when Christine Blasey Ford came forward and we had that high profile, highly emotional and remarkable hearing in front of the Judiciary Committee. The FBI really investigate? Did they get to the bottom of anything? Did they ask 10, 12, 14 people who may have been witnesses in some form to some of the alleged behavior? It appears that they didn't, and people might be relying on Democrats to take up that charge.
Lily?
I'll add to this. You know, Senator Kamala Harris is not just on the Senate Judiciary Committee, but she's also on the Homeland Security and Government Affairs Committee. And in that capacity, she had the chance to grill FBI Director Christopher Wray on this face to face. How much intervention did the White House do in this supplemental background check? Real quick, also on ranking member of the Senate Judiciary Committee, Dianne Feinstein, her 6-year term in the Senate is up. So she's up for re-election. You can bet that this is going to come up in the debate between her and State Senator Kevin De Leon, who wants to know why she sat on that letter from Dr. Christine Blasey Ford for 2 months. And last thing I'll say is she just last night was trying to take the fight from, you know, on this SCOTUS thing to the way that Trump is trying to remake the courts writ large, talking about the Ninth Circuit Court here in California, Trump's nominations. This is a court that's been a real thorn in Trump's side. The White House just put forth 3 nominees there, and she didn't get to sign off on them. She's very upset about that. And Trump's administration is really breaking from tradition by not giving the home state senators any say in these picks.
I do want to see if we can leave time to talk California politics before the roundup is up, but a few more things out of D.C. we wanted to discuss, including the president stepping into the middle of the feud between Taylor Swift and Kanye West. He publicly dissed Miss Swift for endorsing 2 Democrats in Tennessee, and he welcomed Kanye West to the White House yesterday. Kanye wore a red Make America Great Again hat for the visit.
And we're going to have lunch. We're going to talk.
You said, I guess you know I love you.
I know. But I don't want to take, I don't want to put you in that spot. But
no, I'm standing in that spot. I love this guy right here. Let me give this guy a hug right here. I love this guy right here.
That's really nice.
Now, Kanye West was reportedly at the White House to discuss criminal justice reform. He also said yesterday that he doesn't like that liberals and shows like Saturday Night Live make the president look bad. He said the president needs to be, in his words, precious to us as Americans. We should also be clear, though, Shane Harris, Kanye seemed rather rambling during a good bit of his visit, maybe a little unhinged. He had noted that he had been diagnosed with bipolar disorder. I'm hesitant to dig deep in on this story. I think Kanye is easy to mock, easy to make fun of, easy to criticize. But the fact that he said that he is bipolar while he's meeting with the president and dropping some obscenities at the other side of the Resolute desk, I'm not sure what to do with it.
I'm not either. I mean, it was quite surreal. We were actually in the newsroom working on other, what I think are arguably more important stories. So I hesitated to dig too deep on this like you, and looked up at the TV and we all sort of said, is this really happening? It was just so strange. It's hard to know what to make of it. But it is part of a litany of these kind of bizarre carnivalesque spectacles that we've seen both sometimes in the Oval Office and from the president that have the flavor more of a reality show. I mean, that seemed to remind us of the milieu that Donald Trump came out of when he ran for president. And so in that sense, I suppose it's not that surprising, but I think for a lot of people, there's a sense that it almost diminishes the office of the president to see this sort of rambling, bizarre, what do we make of it behavior from a celebrity that has been outspoken about his politics, and that's his right, but has also left many people scratching his head about what is he actually doing and is there something wrong with him? It was just a very strange moment. And I know for me and my colleagues, we just tried to move past it as quickly as we could.
Yeah, in the interest of moving past it as quickly as we could, we'll do that too. But I should note that Kanye's old nemesis Taylor Swift inserted herself into politics this week. She endorsed Democrats Phil Bredesen for Senate and Jim Cooper for the House in her home state of Tennessee on social media. The Senate race in Tennessee is tight, and Bredesen has strong support. Taylor Swift has 112 million followers on Instagram, and voter registrations among young people rose by more than 60,000 after her post. Shane Harris, let me stick with you for a moment, because President Trump is facing another difficult situation regarding the disappearance of a journalist named Jamal Khashoggi. He's a Saudi dissident and a resident of the U.S. He disappeared inside the Saudi consulate in Turkey. You've been doing a fair bit of reporting on this, particularly the concern that the Turks have raised that the Saudis basically sent hitmen to kill Jamal Khashoggi because of his reporting. The Turkish government hasn't really provided any independent evidence for this. They say they have security video and logs of people who signed in and so forth. What do we actually know right now, if anything, about what really happened?
Right. Well, what we know right now is largely coming from the Turks and Turkish security agencies. What we reported last night, my colleagues and I in the Post late last night, was that the Turks have told the Americans that they actually have audio recordings and video from inside the consulate that they say definitively proves that Jamal Khashoggi, who was an opinion writer for the Post, the Washington Post, was beaten, tortured, killed, and ultimately dismembered inside that facility. The Americans, that we understand, have not seen the footage or heard it themselves, but there is a growing belief within the U.S. intelligence community and I think within Congress and the White House that the Saudis probably did kill Jamal Khashoggi and are not at all being forthcoming about that. This is a politically difficult situation for this president in particular because the White House is so close to the regime in Saudi Arabia. Jared Kushner, the president's son-in-law and senior advisor, is actually very personally close to a man named Mohammed bin Salman, the crown prince of Saudi Arabia. And I broke a story earlier this week that before Jamal Khashoggi went missing, bin Salman had actually ordered an operation to try and lure him back, perhaps under false pretenses, to Saudi Arabia where he could be detained. Khashoggi's been very critical of Mohammed bin Salman. So this looks to be like potentially a kidnapping gone wrong in Istanbul. It's not clear whether Mohammed bin Salman ordered this killing. He seems clearly to have tried to order a way to get Khashoggi back. But this is a politically very fraught and dicey moment for the White House. And of course, it has lots to say that we could talk about as well about press freedom, both in the United States and in Saudi Arabia.
Lily?
Real quick, the tech industry here in Silicon Valley is watching this closely also because there is a lot of Saudi money sloshing around in technology companies here. Just yesterday, you had the CEO of Uber, huge figure, Dara Khosrowshahi, pulling out of a gathering that's often referred to as Davos in the desert because of this. So I think he's really putting his money where his mouth is and doing so at a time when Uber has taken in billions of dollars in direct money from the Saudis.
Dara Khosrowshahi, he's Iranian,
I think.
Born in Tehran, I believe.
I don't know if he was born in Tehran. He is Iranian-American.
Todd, can you say a quick word about the kind of position this puts the U.S. in? I mean, the U.S. does have a fair amount of dealings with Saudi Arabia right now, including military dealings.
A lot of dealings. And when you saw the president's response yesterday in the Oval Office to reporters' questions about this, the president said, I don't like it. I don't like it one bit, it appears. Jamal Khashoggi went in the embassy and then never came out. And then pivoted right away to point out that Khashoggi was not an American citizen, which seems to have a subtext of maybe not my problem, and then pointed out the $110 billion that Saudi Arabia is spending on American weapons deals, went as far as to say, do you want that money going to great American companies like Raytheon and McDonnell Douglas and Boeing, or do you want them going to China? This was the president's thinking over how the United States should react to the probable murder of an American resident and a journalist. And I will point out as well, this conference that Lily mentioned, the Saudi-sponsored economic development conference, media co-sponsors, American media companies, including CNN, CNBC, others have all pulled out of this conference. Steve Mnuchin, the Secretary of the Treasury, as of right now, is still going. The Trump administration is still in. They're still all in for MBS, for Mohammed bin Salman, and they are not pulling out, basically showing their support. And the president's statement, while saying he's concerned about it, has presidential concern, made it very, very clear, I'm afraid to say, that he really doesn't.
I'm Joshua Johnson. You're listening to 1A. Can't come to California without talking a little bit about California politics. And so, Lily, let me camp out with you for a bit. You spent some time in California's Central Valley, that corridor that runs on either side of Interstate 5, talking to people about the upcoming elections. Here is a clip from Bill Pine in Visalia, California. Listen.
Well, it's been at least a long time since I've seen such negative campaigning on both sides. And whether it's Republican or Democratic, I just wish people would be more positive about saying what their ambition is or what they plan to do as a politician instead of just trying to discredit the opponent.
That's Bill Pine in Visalia, California, closer to Highway 99, further east inland from Interstate 5. What else did you hear from voters in the area? Visalia is a GOP stronghold.
It is. And this is actually the district that's held currently by a guy you might have heard of, Devin Nunes. Bill Pine is a longtime supporter of Devin Nunes. He was actually on his way to a Nunes campaign event. Nunes was appearing with Jason Chaffetz, a former congressman from Utah, now a Fox News personality, to try and raise some campaign funds. And I was struck by what Bill said to me, because he said at one point, "I've gotten to the point where I don't believe anyone anymore." And that was really reflective of what I saw across that district. You know, there's deep distrust, frankly, in the national media. It was challenging to kind of do that icebreaker to talk to people, because they were like, "Where are you from?" And they've been approached by, you know, multiple national
outlets. Probably
everybody,
yeah.
And, you know, it was a case where you got to go there. And, you know, I show up at his high school and ended up talking to his ag teacher for about 20 minutes. And he told me that multiple outlets had tried to contact him, and he always says no, for the most part. So you see a real wariness. And this is a district that has a lot of serious issues. We're talking about high levels of poverty, high levels of illiteracy, and water contamination. I think there is a sense that Devin Nunes has gotten somewhat distracted by all this Russia stuff, or the Russia conspiracy, as one person put it. And, you know, is that taking some of his focus and attention away from local issues? Quite possibly.
KQED had a big coup this week, hosting California's one and only debate between the two major party candidates, Democratic Lieutenant Governor Gavin Newsom and Republican rival John Cox. Just briefly, Lily, any major takeaways? I mean, Gavin Newsom has kind of been angling for this job for a long, long time.
A long time, as you know well from having spent some time here yourself. The key issue here, I think, is really going to be housing. They spent a lot of time talking about that in this debate. Everyone agrees that the situation is bad. You know, people are leaving California, and where are they going? They're going to places like Texas and Arizona, Oregon, places where the cost of living is lower. The housing affordability issue has hit a lot of people here very hard. John Cox, the Republican in this race, is trying to play up his role as a home builder for many years. He's a businessman from San Diego. He says, you know, in his own experience, he's seen how expensive it is to build new housing here. The approval times can go on for years. He compares, you know, building a unit in Indiana, you need 6 months, versus here it can take up to 15 years. He was a little vague, admittedly, on how he plans to address that. Newsom, for his part, is talking about how the state doesn't have specific objectives and timelines in place. And so the criticism Cox leveled at him was, well, you've been in office for 16 years. You know, where have you been on this all this time? First as mayor of San Francisco and then as lieutenant governor. You know, Trump looms large in this race, but he's not you know, mentioned a whole lot. In fact, Cox never said the word Trump during the debate that was held in the studio right next to us. He did get Trump's endorsement, and they do have some alignment on particular issues like the border wall and sanctuary law.
Lily Jamali, co-host and correspondent for the California Report here at KQED. Lily, thanks for talking to us. Shane Harris, intelligence and national security reporter for the Washington Post. Thanks, Shane.
Thanks, Joshua.
And political journalist and radio host Todd Zwillick. Thanks, Todd.
A pleasure. Thanks, Joshua.
1A's lead sound engineer is Jake Cherry. Our digital team is Gabrielle Healy and Catherine Fink. To learn more about them and the rest of our team, visit the1a.org/staff. Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thank you so much for listening from KQED, and enjoy your weekend. We're back in D.C. Monday. This is 1A.